This is the Swift by Sundell podcast, the show that answers your questions about Swift development. Hi, everybody, and welcome back for episode number 42 of this podcast. I'm your host, John Sundell, and I've got a very special guest with me for this episode. He is the manager of the languages and runtimes team at Apple. It's Ted Kremenek. Welcome to the show, Ted.
Hey, everyone. Very happy to be on the show, John.
Yeah, it's really great to have you on. And the timing couldn't have been better because you and your team at Apple, you have just shipped the Swift 5 beta as part of the Xcode beta. So I know that this one has been in the works for quite a while. So how does it feel to start getting it out the door and into developers' hands?
It's a bit surreal. I'm immensely proud of the people who made it happen. As you said, it's been a work that's been going on for a while. But many people, both in like the Swift community, my team at Apple, just a lot of people worked hard over multiple releases to bring all those pieces together that culminate with ABI stability. And it's a really huge inflection point in the story of Swift as a language, which we'll get into. And I think it's incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I completely agree, especially the ABI stability part, which is what we're going to focus mostly on for this episode, because it's obviously like one of the really big kind of headliner features of Swift 5. And it's a pretty major milestone in the evolution of the language as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So speaking about the Swift evolution and the evolution of the language, when you set out to scope out a new release, let's say, you know, Swift 5 in this case, how do you usually decide kind of what features to focus on and what's going to make the cut and what's going to be saved for a future version?
It's a great question. I think one thing people should keep in mind that Swift is still a relatively young language. And so a lot of our planning has come down to just pragmatic priorities. So in the early releases, we just needed to focus on the core fundamentals. So you had big pieces that were missing in, and that we wanted to add over time. There was like error handling, fleshing out the generic system. These are all part of what we define what Swift is as a language. And then as the language grew in use, other priorities emerged from that, such as like establishing like the clear API guidelines for what Swift code should look like, and then related how Objective-C code should, you know, from particularly from Apple's SDKs should be imported into Swift. All this was really about building out the fundamentals. And so these are, it's just the very pragmatic things that we wanted to, you know, build Swift up and gel it in its core. And then as Swift has become more widely used and successful, there's a lot of interest to take it, you know, further in different ways. And many of these are really clear priorities for the language over the long term. And so it just comes down to like a stack ranking of like this, the expected reward to the, you know, the Swift ecosystem, how much focus those tasks, you know, will need at a time, you know, how much we can really, you know, scale in terms of language design. But just as an aside, as the community grows, particularly with Swift being an open source project, there's a lot of growth potential for Swift that can happen in, you know, in parallel in multiple directions. And, you know, various people can invest in Swift in different ways and take it, you know, further on different fronts over multiple releases. So I think the actual core focus of the release, it does set some themes, but I don't think it's an overriding, you know, priority over other things happening.
Right. And we can see this in Swift 5 as well, where the main focus was obviously to stabilize the ABI. And, you know, that's what I guess you've been focusing on a lot internally at Apple on getting those kind of fundamentals in place in order to stabilize the ABI. But we've also seen a lot of contributions from the community to implement kind of more high level features for this release as well, such as result type and other changes as well.
Right. And those have all been really great enhancements.
Yeah, absolutely. And this all comes down to how Swift is kind of designed as a language. And I know that some other languages follow a similar kind of approach, but for me, as someone who's been mostly kind of a programmer within Apple's ecosystem for a while, this is kind of new to me, this like very community-driven language design, which is super interesting. And of course, I'm talking about the kind of Swift evolution process. So could you take us through a little bit, like how does an idea kind of go from being pitched on the Swift forum to all the way to kind of being shipped into a Swift release?
Well, it's both a formal and informal process, right? I mean, it's really about putting ideas through the rock tumbler and having some kind of structure to have those conversations. So first, you know, ideas start out as pitches in the forum. There's literally a category on the forum where people can pitch their ideas. They can be in rougher form, and they basically can get an initial round of feedback. You know, often people put together, you know, prototypes of essentially what will be a formal, you know, written down design of how the language should, or the standard library should evolve. And then at some point, those do get written down, and they're written down as a markdown file. And they're proposed as a pull request on the Swift Evolution repository on GitHub, which is just, you know, it just serves to be this archive of all the evolution proposals. And then the core team goes about and schedules reviews for you know, particular reviews when they feel those reviews are ready. So how this process gets executed in practice has evolved over time. I think in Swift 4, we start asking for implementations, or at least, you know, rough implementations for proposals. And we did that for two reasons. First was to show that the idea could be implemented at all. And that gives us a taste of just the added complexity to the language, which is a really important design concern we take into account when we're talking about changing the language.
Yeah.
And second, you know, without that vetting, we were getting proposals that just were getting improved but never really implemented. And that's not really, you know, great either. Because, you know, as time goes forward, the context in which those proposals were originally evaluated will change.
Yeah, I think that us as developers, you know, many of us, we really like to talk about code, and we like to talk about different ways of solving a given problem. And I think that you can easily end up in this kind of infinite loop kind of state where you're just discussing things over and over again and never really reaching a kind of conclusion or an implementation.
Right.
So I guess that's also kind of a way to kind of mitigate that.
Yeah, I mean, it has trade-offs, and I think we're still continuing to find, you know, the right balance. One thing I could say is that the process could become more consistent and more streamlined, really, with the scheduling proposals.
Yeah.
Some proposals aren't in clear shape to run, and they need stewardship, and so particularly from the core team. Some proposals are sort of like really deep changes. Some are shallow ones. We've also gotten feedback that sometimes it'd be good to consider a group of things more, you know, together as part of like a larger design conversation. So it's both a formal process, but it also just takes a lot of insightful stewardship, you know, both from the core team and from the community, into understanding when are the right time to have those conversations. And so it's not perfect, and it's something we continue to improve, but I'm also very happy with the results that the process has produced.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like the way that the Swift Evolution process is set up is kind of, you know, what's anchoring the community in many ways, where the fact that the language is designed in the open and anyone can contribute kind of generates this more kind of welcoming atmosphere in the community that, you know, this is something we're all in on together. You know, it's not something that, you know, one party is doing, but rather everyone is kind of pitching in and helping out.
Right. That's absolutely the goal.
Yeah, that's awesome. So the team at Apple that works on Swift, I guess, works on many different parts of it. And one big part of Swift is the standard library. And this is the major part of the main Swift repo, which is actually implemented in Swift itself, because the compiler is in C++. So when you write Swift code in the standard library, how much does kind of that code influence what gets added to the language or the evolution of the language itself?
That's a great question. So the evolution of the standard library and the evolution of the language often go hand in hand, and there's a couple reasons for it. So you can really think of them as complementary blocks, you know, being put together. So one way to look at it is much of what we consider part of the Swift, you know, language is defined in the standard library. So for many people, when you walk up to Swift, you could consider fundamental types like integers, you know, string, et cetera. They're part of the language. Like, that's what you walk up to any kind of programming language, and you just expect some kind of batteries included, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, of stuff that's there. In some languages, like, for example, like in C, many of those types are defined essentially, you know, in the logic in the compiler and like the specific operations and all that. In Swift, they're all defined in the standard library. Like, int is defined in the standard library, and it's implemented using, you know, like operator plus and things like that. And it's essentially, it's like microcoded to basically use, you know, LVM built-ins, these like intrinsic operations that it can then implement the lower level, you know, semantics, but it's all defined in the standard library. And so you could see just at that very fundamental level how interrelated they are. And then if you bubble up a level where we have collections and all these protocols in the standard library, the expression of what we want the standard library to have is really defined by what's possible in the language.
Yeah.
And so you've seen over several releases as the generics, you know, system, the capabilities there evolved to facilitate, you know, more directly what we wanted to express in the standard library adopted it. So that's another example of how, you know, we had an idea of what we wanted generics to be able to do. We knew a way that we wanted standard library to be able to express those concepts. So they go hand in hand.
Yeah, I think that's also a really great resource for people like myself, for example, you know, who write about the language and for people learning the language as well, is that you can look at the standard library and you can get a pretty good example of what's possible with some of these constructs. Like you mentioned the generic system, for example, and things like, you know, extensions with generic constraints and things like that. Like those examples in the standard library, I think were really instrumental in order to get a very clear sense of what that feature kind of was for.
That's right, right. It shows you the power, but also shows you like the, how the design is meant to, you know, meld with the implementation. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
There was one other idea that that point that came to mind is we've seen, so like the standard library defines some key protocols like hashable and equatable, and we've seen some, you know, user-friendly affordances added to the language to like synthesize, you know, conformances to those protocols. So that's a case of like, we had a core concept that we wanted, you know, many types, user, you know, user-defined types to adopt, but the compiler, you know, had some additions added to it to, you know, the language had some additions added to basically grease the wheels of adopting those things, you know, well. So that's an interesting like third kind of axis of how those two are interrelated to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there were a lot of pull requests around the world when that feature landed, just removing a whole lot of hashable and equatable code from, you know, all over the community, which was really, really great. So now I think we should start diving into our main topics for this episode. And for this episode, we want to focus on Swift 5 and most importantly, the ABI stability part, because that's a huge part of this release. I know a lot of work has gone into it. It's been a lot of synchronization between, you know, different developers and different features in order to get ABI stability to be possible. But before we get into that, let's take a very quick break and thank our first sponsor. Now, this is a brand new sponsor, which I am really excited about, and it's my good friends at Zeppelin. When working together with designers, which most of us developers do one way or another, it can sometimes be tricky to establish a smooth and efficient workflow when it comes to getting the right up-to-date assets, information about colors and margins, and so on. It's so easy for things to get lost in translation and for the final implementation to look very different from what the designer originally intended. But with Zeppelin, that problem goes away. When using Zeppelin, a designer can directly import their designs, whether that's from Sketch, Photoshop, or another app, and Zeppelin will automatically generate all the information that you need as the developer to make that UI come to life in the app. It lets you and your designers have a shared single source of truth, since a Zeppelin file becomes a living document that everyone in the team can have access to, which can really help improve the collaboration within a team. As the developer, you can see the exact colors that each part of the UI should have. You can hover the mouse over individual UI elements to see margins, sizes, and other metrics. And for labels, you can see detailed font properties, such as line and letter spacing, and so much more. But that's just the beginning, because Zeppelin can instantly export all of the assets that you need, like images, icons, and even colors, directly into Xcode's asset catalog format, with support for all of the required screen resolutions. And using Zeppelin's powerful extension system, it can even generate Swift code for you, such as app-specific extensions for UI color and UI font, and even generating NS-attributed strings for style text. How cool isn't that? Now finally, once you've gotten all of the assets and information that you need into the code and into the app, Zeppelin also includes a super handy tool that lets you overlay the original design right on top of the iOS simulator. Just press one button in the Zeppelin app, and you'll be able to instantly spot any inconsistencies between your UI code and the design. So check out Zeppelin today by going to zeppelin.io. That's Zeppelin.io to learn more, and you can get started for free. I think you'll be amazed at how much faster and smoother Zeppelin can make designers and developers work together. Thanks so much to Zeppelin for sponsoring this show and all of Swift by Sundell. So about ABI stability, I think we should start with some of the basics. So Ted, could you just explain a little bit, what does it mean for Swift to actually become ABI stable, and what is an ABI?
Right. Yeah. Let's start with some terminology. ABI, the acronym stands for Application Binary Interface. In a nutshell, it defines how, you know, the compiled code, when it runs, interacts with other compiled code. You know, so it's really like a runtime set of rules, you know, for defining how code interacts to each other at runtime. So compiled languages like C, Objective-C, et cetera, they all have some form of ABI. So this will include things like, you know, calling conventions, name mangling, the layout of objects in memory, and so on. So it's a lot of different things.
Yeah.
So compiled Swift code, such as an application or a library that have compatible ABIs, can interact with each other, such as calling functions and methods defined in each other, passing values back and forth across API boundaries, et cetera. So that's what ABI allows. Compiled Swift code that did not have compatible ABIs essentially can't interact with each other at runtime. You know, that's fundamentally what ABI enables. So Swift has always had an ABI. Every release of Swift has an ABI. Like every, you know, the code that you compile with one version of Swift is compatible with the code, you know, compiled with the same compiler. But we've been evolving it over time as, you know, the core pieces of the language, you know, gel together. As we knew that there was particular representational issues in the ABI we wanted to address.
Yeah.
So what does it mean for the ABI to be stable? It means that key aspects are locked in, or at least support some kind of forward compatibility with interacting with Swift binaries compiled by, you know, later compilers. So this means you can compile a Swift library in one release and still be able to, you know, interact with it at runtime with an application that was built with a later version of Swift, or vice versa.
Right. Yeah, that's also really important. So that means that going forward from Swift 5, you can take a framework or an SDK or something that was compiled with a different future version of the compiler, and your binary, your application, or your framework can still interact with those because they have the same kind of shared calling convention. They know how to talk to each other.
That's right.
That's really powerful, but I can imagine that must have been quite a amount of work to actually decide, you know, what those calling conventions would be, and to also future-proof it, like you said, to enable future versions of the language to actually interact with the current version of the language. So what kind of changes had to be made to the compiler itself and also to the standard library in order to achieve this ABI that we can now call stable?
You know, ABI stability was a Swift 5, you know, deliverable. The changes that have led up to it happened over several Swift releases. And I think you really started to see this, particularly with Swift 4, how, you know, the direction really started to be particularly set. We rolled out, there was some long perspective manifestos, such as for memory ownership, the, you know, the strings representation, all that stuff, that were charting out a course for, you know, many of the fundamentals in the language. And then what you saw in Swift 4, Swift 4, 2, Swift 5 was just like more of those pieces falling into place. So let's take the example of memory ownership, which did have one of those manifesto. In Swift 4, we started moving the language towards recognizing the need to have a discipline of what we called exclusive access to memory.
Right.
So we started, you know, basically majorly defining a future direction for Swift's memory model. And the memory model is a key part of the semantics of any language, but definitely for Swift. Swift's memory exclusivity enforcement is a combination of static enforcement by the compiler, but also runtime checks. And runtime checks are obviously part of the, you know, runtime's part of the ABI. So in Swift 4, the runtime checks were enabled in unoptimized and bug builds. And then over time, we've refined the compiler's implementation so that the enforcement and the overhead of that enforcement at runtime is acceptable and optimized, you know, the release builds as well. And so with that in Swift 5, that's essentially now part of the core, you know, that's part of the core language model.
Right.
And the ABI actually assumes that that is enforced, that that's part of the language model. And the whole reason we did that is so that we can really lay the groundwork needed for, you know, more memory ownership features in the language. So there's, we're not done there with where we can take the language. So we had an idea of what we wanted to build. What were the key pieces that need to be steered in place, you know, for the ABI? And then with the ABI, what can you, you know, build on going forward? So there was other things too. There was just a lot of stuff we needed to do, right? I mean, like as we've evolved things like the standard library over time, there were missing features in the compiler, like critically in the generic system that we, you know, implemented over time. So there was just a lot of cleanup we needed to do to like just express, yeah. You know, and while we've tried to have, you know, good source compatibilities, particularly in the last few Swift releases, we haven't had needed to fix in the ABI for some of like the way, you know, the standard library is implemented. So you might be, you know, in previous Swift releases, you might have recompiled your code and compiled just fine, but how it worked under the hood in the standard library may have changed, you know, quite significantly.
Right, exactly.
So like with ABI, like we have to get, you know, how it's actually going to be implemented, what are the actual symbols, types, all that exposed by the standard library, have to get, you know, pretty much settled, so we just, you know, we just can't change them from a binary compatibility perspective going forward. So that was a big thing that we needed to do as well.
Yeah, I can totally imagine, because as a Swift developer, like all of these things, to your point, is kind of like a little bit opaque, right? Where
right.
you just take your source code and you compile it, but you could take that very same source code in Swift 4.2, not make any changes to it, then take the Swift 5 compiler and the underlying binary will be completely different.
That's right. And beyond cleanups, we had a lot of forward-looking stuff to implement. So we've long had huge ambitions for the language. We know of things that we want to be able to potentially do one day. One of the things we did, particularly in Swift 5, was make sure that the runtime metadata was rich enough to be able to build what a lot of folks would consider more like runtime dynamism in the language. We also looked at core choices of representation for the sake of performance, such as moving string to UTF-8. Just all these things were very critical for looking at the long term of the stuff that we wanted to build Swift towards going forward. So we have a lot of perspective of where we want Swift to go or be able to go as a language, and all that, you know, formulated into the work that was needed for ABI stability.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. And I can imagine, to your point, that you need to really look forward if you're going to stabilize the ABI, because you need to start thinking about like what kind of features do we want this language to have, especially when it comes to like more dynamic things that need to have access to that metadata. Once the ABI is stable, that metadata can't change, you know, in the same way.
Yeah, in the same way. It can still evolve. But yeah, I mean, it can't just completely change.
Right, exactly. So along those lines, are there any features that will be kind of harder to implement now that the ABI is stable? Is there anything where, you know, you had to make those decisions now or kind of, you know, leave them because now the ABI is stable, so that door is kind of closed?
That's a great question. And I think it's also a source of anxiety for some folks.
Right.
So first, not everything in the runtime is necessarily exposed as ABI. I mean, it's something that's like internal to, you know, the runtime of Swift, and certainly those pieces can certainly evolve, you know, over time. It's also quite, you know, natural to extend, you know, the ABI to support, you know, newer features. So implementing newer features per se isn't necessarily going to be a lot harder. I mean, we can't just like reshuffle, you know, a lot of very fundamental things, but that's not what we're interested in really doing anyway, right? I mean, we want to continue to build, you know, more stuff on top of the fundamentals.
Right.
I think the case of the real tricky part is adding language features that will require us to extend the runtime, which will ship, you know, in the OS. And if those language features, you know, require us to add things to the runtime, those changes won't be in Swift runtimes that shipped in, you know, earlier OS releases. And so for those kinds of things, we'll essentially be presented with two options. You can either gate the use of the language feature on running on, you know, an OS with that, you know, that runtime support, which is, you know, what we did for Objective-C and in many cases, or we can look for ways to retrofit the needed runtime support in the app. And we've definitely have a history at Apple of finding creative approaches to that as well.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Right. Well, I mean, actually, if you think about it, Swift itself, the way we've been shipping it is essentially, you know, the way we've been shipping with the embedded, you know, runtime. That essentially is, you know, that kind of approach.
Right.
So different approaches have limits and trade-offs. There's no single solution that's necessarily the right approach. I think we'll just assess it on a case-by-case basis of, you know, and evaluate what's possible and also what's really important for supporting that backwards deploying, because Apple's, you know, user base actually does move very quickly, you know, to newer OS releases. So we'll just have to, you know, examine it on a case-by-case basis. But ABS stability, I think it mostly cements in the foundation. We can still continue to do lots of great things to the language.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in a way, it's kind of like when we third-party developers wants to kind of retrofit a new feature in a new version of iOS to also work on older versions. You could sometimes do that with, you know, an extension or something that just kind of implements that new API yourself.
Right.
And I guess you could also take the same approach with the ABI, you know, like you say, to ship that little compatibility layer in the app to also make it work for older operating systems.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, exactly. It's that kind of idea, right? You know, put in the functionality that you need that isn't there.
Exactly. So there's another kind of big piece going on right now with Swift, which relates to ABI stability, and that's module stability. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what's the difference between ABI stability and module stability, and what's going on with that?
Sure. So this is a little tricky. So there's really two key parts that are needed to ship Swift binary frameworks that you can just kind of like pass around and compile against and use at runtime. So ABI stability solidifies the rules of how two pieces of compiled Swift code can be linked together, you know, loaded together and operate together at runtime. So we talked about that.
Yeah.
Module stability basically defines the stable format of vending the API in the Swift framework, right? So when you compile like an app and you're, you know, importing an API from the framework, there has to be some kind of manifest, you know, something that describes what is the API that is vended by the framework. In C and Objective-C and C++, those are, you know, user-authored, you know, header files. In Swift, they're module files that are produced by the compiler when the framework is actually, you know, built. So they're all just produced, right? You know, they're synthesized right from the code. So the format of the Swift module file that we have today is a binary format that is really optimized for compile time. So in many ways, it's very similar to the pre-compiled headers that are produced by Clang for C-based languages. It has it's basically a serialization of a lot of the compilers, you know, specific representation of the APIs. It's got, you know, type checking that's fully done, all that stuff. And that is, you know, so the problem with that is it gets very locked in with the particular compiler that produced it, because it's really optimized for speed.
Right.
With module stability, what we'll have, and this has been posted on the forum, Swift will have a new file called a Swift interface file, and that's going to be a stable module format. It's actually going to look, you know, it's going to look like Swift source code, and it's not tied to a particular Swift compiler. It all rides off of that source compatibility, you know, that source stability that we've been, you know, having in Swift for several years. And so when these Swift interfaces are read in by the Swift compiler, what's going to happen under the hood is they're going to be transparently translated into that Swift module file that we have today. But the end result is you're going to have this stable module format that could be used as binary frameworks. So with module stability and ABI stability, it'll be possible to vend binary frameworks built with Swift.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I think that's something that a lot of people have been waiting for a little bit. And you know, it unlocks more use cases of Swift, which is always a great thing. You know, if some team has had that as like a blocker for Swift adoption because they use, you know, these kind of pre-compiled frameworks as part of their tool chain, well, that's now been unlocked. And, you know, once this piece lands and we have module stability in, yeah, that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, it's going to be really enabling to really unlock a huge amount of potential in the Swift ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so next up, we want to switch gears a little bit and talk about strings. Because for Swift 5, a lot of work has also gone into improving the internals of Swift strings. But before we do, let's take another quick break and thank our second and final sponsor. And it's my good friends at Instabug. How about both getting better bug and crash reporting and a better tool for communicating with your users, and also get a free t-shirt? Well, that's exactly what Instabug offers all listeners of this show. Instabug is quite simply a complete package for improving the quality and user experience of your app. Here's how it works. You install their SDK through a simple 1-minute installation guide. They'll give you detailed crash reports if anything goes wrong, and it also allows you to establish a seamless 2-way communication channel between you, your testers, and even your end users. For example, one of my personal favorites is Instabug's in-app feedback feature. At any point while testing your app, a beta tester can simply shake their phone. That brings up this super nice feedback UI that they can use to send you feedback, along with screenshots, annotations, and Instabug will also automatically collect all of the diagnostics that you need in order to reproduce a bug, to fix a crash, or to track down a layout issue. That makes bug reports reported through Instabug, whether they're user-reported or automatic crash reports, so much more actionable and quicker to fix. For you as the developer, Instabug also comes with an easy-to-use UI that intelligently aggregates crashes and issues into useful charts, overviews, as well as detailed reports containing stack traces, reproduction steps, and, for crashes, the exact line of code that caused the crash. Instabug also integrates with all sorts of third-party tools, such as Jira, Slack, Trello, and GitHub. So Instabug is not just a crash reporter. It's a complete solution for improving your app's quality and for communicating with your users. You can add an in-app chat so that not only can people report bugs to you, they can also request new features, or they can tell you what they like about your app. So try out Instabug today and see just how much smoother it can make your app development, dealing with bugs and crashes, and communicating more with your users and beta testers. Go to instabug.com/Sundell. You go there, you sign up for free, you install their SDK in just a few minutes, try it out, and guess what? You'll get a free Instabug t-shirt. I think that's pretty cool. Again, that's instabug.com/Sundell to sign up for free, get a cool t-shirt, and improve your team's workflow. Thanks so much again to Instabug for their continued support of Swift by Sundell and this podcast. So apart from the underlying pieces about ABI and module stability and these kind of things we've talked about, strings have also changed quite a lot in this release. There are both kind of user-facing features like raw strings, you've got a new interpolation API that you can use, and there's even a new interpolation engine under the hood. So in regards to strings, what other kind of under-the-hood improvements have been made in Swift 5?
So everything you mentioned, those are all really fantastic improvements to string. In Swift 5, I would say hands down the biggest under-the-hood change is the move to using UTF-8 for the Unicode representation for native strings.
Yeah.
And this is consistent on both Apple and non-Apple platforms, such as Linux. And it's a really important change when we consider Swift's trajectory as a great language for, you know, lower-level systems programming, you know, high performance for, you know, writing, you know, services, you know, things like that. Because a lot of string processing, UTF-8 is really very good in those contexts. But getting that change required a lot of work, particularly with interoperability with NSString, to make sure that we, you know, achieved, you know, our overall performance goals all around for the different cases that we care about.
Yeah, because when you pass a Swift string around, it can implicitly get converted between NSString and a Swift string. And that's not something that you always see as the API user because you're just dealing with Swift strings. But under the hood, the kind of storage has been changed to be, you know, pure UTF-8. And yeah, what you're saying is that there was kind of a lot of work to get that to work together with our good old friend NSString.
That's right. NSString continues to use UTF-16.
Right.
Right. So we haven't changed, you know, NSString really at all, but Swift string, you know, bridges to NSString. So as a Swift string is passed into the Objective-C world as NSString, it still needs to have really good performance, right? Because it's all your UI code and all that, right? And the default encodings are different. But we've found out that, like, in the most part, this really isn't a problem, but there are APIs in NSString that definitely present kind of a UTF-16 based view of the underlying, like, they're basically expecting that the string is UTF-16. And so we didn't want atrocious performance because of, like, you know, of like lots of hidden transcoding. I'm not the real expert here. Michael Osmond's the really one who understands all the details as he implemented them. But we, you know, we did different kinds of, like, dynamic breadcrumbing techniques and so forth so that As you're kind of like translating between those two worlds, you're trying to be as efficient as possible. And so really trying to make String be high performance for systems programming, great, you know, for, you know, Cocoa programming, just like all those things. That was a really hard space for us to explore. And we're certainly not done with String. Like, there's a lot more ergonomics we should add to it to make it even more powerful, easier to do some core tasks and so on. So, hopefully with ABS stability, we've handled much of like the representational challenges of String, and we can move on and focus on some of those other pieces that are definitely not there yet.
It's really funny, you know, how much work can, you know, be required in order to represent text, but
yeah, totally.
Yeah. Since text has evolved so much, it also makes sense when you think about it. But, you know, when you look at it from kind of a, you know, just a outside view, you can sometimes think to yourself, you know, how hard can it be? But it turns out it can be really hard.
That's right. And the amplifying factor is really huge. Like, String is used in so, you know, for so much.
Yeah, absolutely. So about strings, you spoke a little bit earlier about, you know, the ownership model of strings and how that relates to ABI. And another thing also that that is relevant here is memory exclusivity. We talked a little bit about it briefly before, but Swift 5 now turns on the new memory exclusivity checks for all builds, not only for debug builds, but even release. So does that have any impact for like us as app developers? Do we need to think about this in any way? Or is that more like an under the hood kind of thing?
Well, I think what it means is that Swift in practice will become an even safer language. The runtime checks will catch, you know, code patterns that previously could have resulted in some surprising or hard to diagnose behavior. Knowing that the runtime checks are enforced also allows the compiler to take advantage of that property in the memory model. It opens up some optimization opportunities. So for a user's perspective, it means potentially faster code, but also means even, you know, safer code. Now, in practice, I don't think we expect the runtime checks to really fire all that often. Like, we've been, you know, evaluating the exclusivity checking over multiple releases. The static enforcement was in place, even starting with Swift 4, right? So even if the runtime checks weren't in place for release builds, the static enforcement was. So the programming model has already, you know, been nudged, you know, incrementally in this direction anyway. But it just really, you know, locks it in.
Yeah, that's perfect. Less kind of bad access crashes, right? And more, you know, good diagnostics when something does go wrong.
Yeah, I don't think it was necessarily crashes, but just
unexpected behavior, perhaps.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, this has been super great. But what do you say? Should we answer some questions from the audience?
Sounds great.
All right, let's do it. So we've gotten quite a lot of questions for this episode. So we've selected a couple of them. And I want to thank everyone who sent in questions for this episode. It was really great to see. And hopefully we'll get to your question. But if not, just know that there were so many of them. And we've been trying our best to answer as many of them as we can. We're going to start with one that has been quite commonly asked in the community kind of ever since Swift first was announced. And that is how Apple itself uses Swift. So we got a question here from JK Cross, and a lot of other people asked this question as well. And that is Swift used in Apple's operating systems? And is server-side Swift used at Apple? So Ted, how does it look? Do we have any internal Swift code at Apple?
Absolutely. We've been using Swift in the OS for quite some time. And to be honest, I've kind of lost track of all the places.
That's a good sign.
In the OS, it is being used. Today, Swift is being used for, you know, for apps, services. There's lots of internal tools, even some internal frameworks in the OS. And if you crack open the app bundles, I think from like the iWork apps, you'll notice that most of them use Swift. So the adoption of OS has really, it's been there, but it's also been held back by ABI stability. ABI stability kind of creates this like siloing, you know, like we've been using Swift in the OS, but that can't actually interact with the Swift that's in your app. And that really, you know, precludes a lot of opportunity to use Swift in the operating system.
Right.
And so we're obviously excited, you know, about it, because that will enable us to build a lot of things.
Yeah.
Server-side Swift, yes, it's absolutely. It's used at Apple in production for customer-facing services. And also, importantly, I think it's worth pointing out that Apple's been playing a larger role in advancing Swift for server development. So when we launched with IBM the Server API effort in 2016, after a year or so of discussing and prototyping development, a group of Apple engineers who worked on server apps at Apple created SwiftNeo. And this was specifically to build a foundation for server-side applications written in Swift.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's now a key component of like many server-side proposals that are coming out of the Swift Working Group, and which is composed of like several companies, including Apple. So, and that group has a lot of, you know, open source proposals in the works that would be like the building blocks for building services. So, and we wouldn't be invested in that if, you know, we didn't care very much about server-side Swift. And we definitely are benefiting from those efforts because we're using it ourselves.
Yeah, that's really amazing to hear. And it also creates this like nice feedback loop, right? Even internally at Apple, where, you know, you are using it yourself, which can feed into the open source process and it can feed into the language itself. And it just makes the language and server-side Swift in particular kind of better for everybody.
Absolutely.
Great. So we've got our next question here from Kabir Oberai. And Kabir wants to know, how does the ABI stability affect the prospect of improving Swift reflection capabilities? For example, if Swift were to get a equivalent of NS class from string. And just to give a very brief kind of recap on what reflection is, it's when you can dynamically interact with methods and properties on a type. And Swift has had a reflection API for quite a while, the mirror type. But this question is more like, how can ABI allow Swift to kind of evolve that aspect of the language?
Right. So a lot of the work, so like we, as I said before, we have a pretty good idea of like the kinds of things that we want to make possible in Swift. So a lot of the work that went into ABI stability was making sure we had the right metadata to support these kinds of capabilities in the future. So that information has to be there for us to build on, like expressing those in the language. There's a fair amount of design work that needs to be done to actually have like the right, you know, user-facing language features to take advantage of that. But a lot of that metadata, it's there. Just for reference, Joe Groff, he gave a great talk on this topic in 2017 at Swift Summit that was titled Swift's Reflective Underpinnings.
Oh, yeah.
And it talked about like both static and dynamic reflection, talking about like the different, you know, kinds of approaches that you could take towards doing what many consider to be kind of like this, you know, dynamism, you know, in the language. And even there, and he mentioned that talk that there's a lot of stuff in the runtime that we can definitely tap into the future. So I think generally speaking, people should not be worried that we're cutting anything off here. I think there's a lot of potential for us to be tapping into here for a long time to come.
Yeah, that's perfect. And we'll definitely put a link to Joe's talk in the show notes. But I totally agree that, you know, Swift has had a different kind of focus than some more kind of dynamic languages that focuses on, you know, you can call any method with a string and do whatever you want and have fun. And Swift has been more focused on kind of verifying things compile time and making sure that we write more safe code. But now that those fundamental building blocks are in place, then, you know, we can take those models and those constructs and build kind of more dynamic things on top of them that make sense for Swift as a language. All right, so the next question comes from Andrew King, and Andrew wants to know how ABI stability impacts the viability of writing distributable frameworks in Swift. So a little bit what we talked about earlier about pre-compiled binary frameworks.
Yeah, I mean, I think we covered most of this. It's in a very important piece. So with ABI stability, you have the ability to compile an app against a framework and then swap in a newer version of that framework without rebuilding the app. With module stability, you'll get a stable format for Swift interfaces, which is the other important piece of distributable frameworks. And that will allow you to build an app using a compiler that's different from the one that built the framework, as the compiler will be able to read the API from the framework. And that's all coming in Swift 5.1.
Perfect. So that won't be a problem at all with the module stability, because
that's right.
You'll be able to use that translation layer we talked about earlier to ensure that, you know, different binaries can talk to each other in a nice way.
That's right.
All right, so our last question for this episode comes from Ray Fix. And Ray wants to know, other than ABI stability, which we've talked quite a lot about, what other feature has you the most excited about Swift 5? So, Ted, are you allowed to have favorite features of Swift? You know?
I definitely care a lot about what we're doing to Swift and where it's going. For me, in Swift 5 in particular, It's really about the future that it unlocks. It's not about any one particular feature. So a big part of Swift's vision is about making it a versatile language that could span the different levels of the software stack. So ABI stability unlocks the ability, you know, for, you know, Swift on the OS to, you know, build a lot more technologies there and interact with the code, you know, in the app. It also allows us to optimize Swift system wide. But looking, you know, broader, we've done really two things. We've laid the foundations for lower level Swift. So there's like launch time improvements by having Swift in the OS, but things like UTF string, very important for for great interoperability with C, that server, server programming. We've laid the foundations for an ownership model, which allow, you know, is to possibly have like move semantics one day. There's the SIMD changes, the code size and performance improvements to make Swift more suitable for daemons and lower level components of the system. All that, you know, that all those stuff, you know, it's we made such huge progress on and laid the foundations for that in Swift 5. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we've laid the foundations for more what we can consider like the higher level Swift, you know, the extensive runtime metadata to support, you know, more reflection capabilities, the dynamic memory lookup, dynamic callable for that more like, you know, possible scripting interoperability with languages like, you know, like Python and so on. So we've really opened it up, you know, for a huge amount of, you know, potential, you know, for the language going forward. And I think that's really the feature of Swift 5 is it's really just, you know, turning the key on broadening Swift's, you know, software ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like one of those like really big milestone releases where, you know, it's really fundamental. And I think we'll probably, you know, talk about it for years to come to say, you know, oh, that's just because this thing that was implemented in Swift 5, whether that is, you know, the ABI stability part or the extended metadata or, you know, the ownership models that came a little bit before it and things like that. But it feels like it's all kind of coming together in order to like build, you know, really rock solid fundamentals that we can build upon.
Yeah, that was definitely the goal. Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's really, really exciting to see. And I think also like, you know, it's easy when you look at Swift 5 to just look at the top level and to say, you know, my favorite feature about Swift 5 is the new result type. And the new result type is really cool. But I think once you start looking kind of a little bit under the hood and you look at things like dynamic callable or the new string interpolation engine, you know, there are some really cool things there and that will enable things that we might not even have thought of yet.
And right. It's all the potential that we've put in, you know, for things to build.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what I'm most excited about Swift 5 as well. And also the fact that, you know, this has been the second major release now where source compatibility has been pretty much kept intact. And, you know, I'm not only saying that because, you know, I always want my source to never break, but it's an indication of how Swift has kind of, you know, matured in a way when it comes to the syntax. And now we can focus on more kind of, you know, under the hood kind of fundamental building blocks. Cool. So that's it for this episode. So all that remains is for me to thank you so much, Ted, for taking the time to join me and for, you know, answering questions from the audience and for telling us more about Swift 5 and ABI stability. So thanks so much for being on the show.
That was absolutely my pleasure. It was thrilling to be here.
Yeah, that's great to hear. So if people want to catch up with you and follow you online, where should they go?
Well, on Twitter, my handle is T Kremnick. There's also the Swift forums where people can direct message me as well. Both of those are totally great ways to get a hold of me.
Perfect. You can also find me on Twitter. I am at John Sundell. And you can find the show notes for this episode in your podcast player or at swiftbysundell.com/podcast/42. Once again, big thanks to both Zeppelin and Instabug for sponsoring this episode. Make sure to check them out in the show notes as well. But most importantly, thank you so much, everybody, for listening. It's truly amazing to see so many people listening to the show, to hear your feedback, and to see people share the show with their friends on Twitter and through other channels. So thank you so much, and I'll talk to you on the next episode.